Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Student Architect Podcast. And today I have my guest, the one and only Matt Dumich. For those of you who have already listened to the Shark episode, you know Matt decently well. But for those of you who may be tuning in for the first time, let me explain a little bit as to who Matt is. Matt Dumich, F-A-I-A, is a principal at Smith Group in Chicago, Illinois. His professional experience includes commercial buildings, interiors, mixed use, developments, and master plans. A dynamic leader and consensus builder, he is known for his collaborative design approach and ability to execute complex, high-performance projects totaling over 10 million square feet constructed worldwide. Matt is a respected leader committed to serving the profession by heightening the visibility of architects, communicating the value of design, and connecting the architectural community. He has held numerous local, regional, and national leadership positions with the American Institute of Architects, most recently serving as the 2017 AIA Chicago Board President. Matt is co-founder of Bridge, a leadership program pairing young architects with FAIA mentors to discuss career advancements and the future of the profession. Since its inception in 2009, Bridge has formed lasting multi-generational mentoring relationships and provided leadership development for more than 150 emerging architects. In 2019, he was approved by the AIA president to lead the National Emerging Professional Task Force and serves on the Board of Trustees for the Chicago Architectural Center. Matt was elevated to the AIA College of Fellows in 2017. Additional honors for his leadership and service include 2015 Crane Chicago Business 40 Under 40, 2013 AIA National Young Architects Award, 2012 AIA Chicago Dublin Family Young Architect Award, and 2011 Building Design and Construction 40 Under 40 Award. And as you can see, Matt is a very accomplished fellow, and I want to thank him highly for taking the time to sit down with me and have this wonderful conversation. Certainly hope you guys get a lot out of it. Without further ado, let's go ahead and jump into today's episode. Thanks so much. I always like to start off with some simple questions about your childhood. I think it's always interesting to hear about where people come from and what their background is and really what maybe were some key markers or what weren't key markers about, you know, you getting into architecture. How would you describe yourself as a young child, you know, growing up, within the single digits? What kind of a kid were you, Matt?
Oh, geez. Single digits. So I was curious. I was a typical boy, liked to get dirty, play in the backyard, play in the sandbox. I was always involved in sports, basketball and volleyball, primarily. And I grew up in Schaumburg, Illinois, kind of typical suburban upbringing.
Yeah.
and in fact, in some ways, I think I went to architecture school as a bit of a reaction to my environment because, I knew there was a better way than the suburbs. I had a great childhood, but I'm an urban person. I love the vitality of the city. And, I've always been, Schaumburg is like the epitome of suburb, especially in the 80s when I was growing up. It was really the big Chicago suburb with the mall and the endless strip malls and car dealerships, and kind of like there was a residential area where people lived, but the kind of front face of Schaumburg is all very much kind of commercial. Where's the place there?
Yeah. Would you say that maybe some of your issues was with that, was the fact that it was mostly based on this sort of commercial first and then residential just, pushed to the sides?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure these perspectives were more formed once I went to college and, you know, got into architecture school to kind of be a critical thinker. But the nice thing about suburban neighborhood is, you know, because it's zoned where there's big areas of residential, you could go all over the place. Like I could walk to school, which was a decent walk to my elementary school without really crossing a major street. And so, you know, you could explore the neighborhood, but it was primarily residential. There were no shops, restaurants, and things like that, which is some of the stuff that I love about living in the city is, you know, having access to a whole variety of things. You know, I live in Roscoe Village right now, and even in this crazy COVID time, you know, there's some small businesses that we like to support and go to, you know, take out at the restaurants. Or now, actually, some days of the week, Roscoe Street is closed for some outdoor dining that allows you to be a little bit more comfortable. So even in this strange time, there's still access. You don't have to get in the car and go everywhere.
Yeah. So would you say that Chicago most likely was your exposure to the big city? When did you start to feel like, you know, you were really starting to enjoy that type of living more so? What were some moments you can remember?
Yeah, so I was always excited about the vitality of the city, you know, as a suburban city kid or suburban kid. We came downtown, you know, a couple times a year, and that was always a big adventure. And so when it came time to thinking about architecture school, my entire high school, or a good majority, went to University of Illinois. And on one hand, you know, I just didn't want to do what everybody else did. I wanted to go kind of chart my own path. But I also didn't want to go to architecture school in a cornfield. And, you know, U of I is a great school, but it just wasn't the right environment for me. And the Chicago schools, frankly, were a little bit too close to home. And so I went to school at UW-Milwaukee, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and I really fell in love with the school and the campus in particular because it's an urban neighborhood, and it was really close to Lake Michigan. And so oftentimes, especially on a stressful day or stressful night, I would walk down to the lake, and there's something comforting about having that big body of water to contemplate the meaning of it all. And so, the campus is, I don't know, it would be the Chicago equivalent to Loyola, where it was in just at the edge of the city in a neighborhood, but had great access to downtown and all students.
What part of Milwaukee did you live in at the time? I've actually been there quite a few times.
Oh. I lived near the campus, and for part of the time I lived in the dorms, and then part of the time I lived nearby off campus in apartments. But, you know, northeast side, or in Milwaukee, it's called the east side. But as a student, you got a free transit pass or bus pass. And so I would often, you know, Milwaukee, even then, you know, this is 20 years ago, had, you know, great, it was a city, but it was a small kind of accessible city. So I loved going downtown we would go to basketball games, both, you know, the Bucks pro games and the Milwaukee UWM team played downtown as well. And also have access to the art museum. And then, of course, while I was there, the Calatrava was built. So it was like you had access to all this culture, but it was just a little bit more accessible than, you know, Chicago as a really big city. And so my whole family is from the Chicago area, and I always knew I would come back. But I loved going to school in Milwaukee and in kind of learning architecture in an urban environment.
Yeah, and I think Milwaukee is such an interesting city as well. When I visited there a few times, it always felt to me like it was, the way my friends and I described it anyways, it was like being in, you know, the neighborhoods of Chicago, as if it was just a neighborhood of Chicago, but just in, you know, Wisconsin. Yeah. And it just had like that density that was dense enough to feel like a city, but it was so secluded in some ways, but you had the lake and everything as well.
Yeah. And because, I mean, the downtown and the, you know, there's not a ton of towers. There's not a major skyline. There's certainly a skyline, but the neighborhoods, like, you know, there were urban neighborhoods that had 100-year-old houses and in like some character and history. And in addition to the houses, there's, you know, kind of south of downtown, the Third Ward and the Fifth Ward would be kind of like, it's the warehouse district, similar to Chicago Fulton Market and, or the kind of west side here in Chicago. So, there are little pockets, they're smaller, but a little bit easier to navigate.
Was Brady Street still a big place to party at the time?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Good bars and restaurants. My best friend, is Italian, and, there's a great Italian, grocery store on Brady Street that we would go to a lot as well.
Hey, awesome. Awesome. Good to know. So while you were studying at UW-Milwaukee, obviously, you know, I just graduated, so I can't, it's hard for me to summarize what I learned because it was so, so dense and every year felt like I was getting slammed with more and more info. But if you could try and just maybe take away some key ideas that you still use to this day or just in general that sort of influenced you, what would be some of those key ideas you took away from UW-Milwaukee?
Yeah. There's a lot. And I would go back again. I actually, not only would I choose to go to UWM again, I would love to go back to college. It was so much fun. So I did my undergrad. I had a BSAS, Bachelor's of Science in Architectural Studies. So 4 years went through. I had the opportunity to study abroad. My junior year, I did a semester in Paris, which was like, you know, just absolutely an incredible experience. You know, when you first go to college, you're exposed to like diversity sometimes for the first time. And then having the opportunity to study abroad in Europe and travel around and just to see the history of the world was just so formative for me. I graduated in 4 years, and then I was super burnt out. I knew I wanted to go back to grad school, but just not right away. So I worked for 2 years in Milwaukee. I worked at a design build firm and got a ton of construction site experience and seeing stuff built. And then I went back to grad school. So that's the kind of background on school. You know, professionals and firm leaders often say, what do you even learn in school? You don't teach it. You don't learn any practical skills. And I totally don't believe that at all. I feel like school, you know, you're learning design thinking or critical thinking. You learn your subconscious. It's the foundational. And so you need that basic education to then learn how to be an architect and to practice. It's such a broad profession. There's so much to know. It's really hard. How could you learn that in 4 years, 5 years, 6 years, whatever? It's just too much. And that's why it's called practice. And so you learn that fundamental conscience. And then you build on that as you go. And the point is that your education isn't over when you get your diploma. You need to keep learning. You learn on the job. And, somewhat recently, a recent grad asked me how to help prepare for an interview and was really worried about going in and showing that she had strong Revit skills. And I said, well, first of all, where did you get that idea? You know, there's just a perception out there that you need to know Revit to get a job. And it helps, no doubt. But I also said, look at the skills and experience that you do have and think about what you really want to do in your career. If this firm wants somebody that's going to exclusively be, a Revit technician, if you will, is that the job you want? Or do you want, and in this case, she was an aspiring designer. And I said, well, your Rhino and Grasshopper skills are going to be their selling point. And that's what you really want to do when you, in your job. Yeah, Revit is part of it, but, you know, that shouldn't be the reason you get a job or you don't get a job. So anyway, you learn the fundamentals. And then for me, you know, taking a few years off was great because I learned what the real world was like. I learned that I really did like architecture and as a profession. And I then could reflect on the real world in grad school and really study what I was really interested in. One of the problems with undergrad is you have so many darn prerequisites that you don't get into architecture very deeply until maybe like, I don't know, for me, it was midway through sophomore year where I felt like I was designing a building. And frankly, I got to a point early in my sophomore year where I was like, here I am in my third semester, and we're doing these abstract exercises. I didn't get it. And it was really, I didn't understand the intent. And I also just struggled with it. And that semester is one that many people kind of fall away and kind of change majors because it is intense. And I'm glad that I just said, okay, let's try one more semester and see how it goes. And that second semester for me in sophomore year was the kind of where the kind of the switch flipped, and I felt like I really loved it. Interesting path. Yeah, and maybe I should share too, like it's so crazy when you're in school and you meet all these people. And your teacher, at least, you know, old school would say, look around this room, you know, by the end of your sophomore year, there's only going to be 10% of you. And that's horrible to kind of celebrate that. You know, this profession should be more about inclusivity than exclusivity and weeding people down. It shouldn't be a rite of passage. But in that, you know, there were people that were pretty hardcore about architecture that had wanted to be an architect since they were, you know, really young in this back in the single digits. And that wasn't me actually. The short version of the story is that, you know, I kind of like you're 18 or 17 and you have to pick something for college. And I did, and it kind of stuck. And I feel fortunate that, you know, I developed a love for it and I persevered, but there were people you just feel awful. They had this probably 10-year kind of dream of becoming an architect, and they might have dropped out of the program before the end of maybe sophomore year, which is horrible.
Yeah. No, yeah, I had a very similar experience. I mean, when I was a freshman, we had 120 kids, and I think we graduated with 50. Just around 50. So it's definitely something that happens in probably a majority of these schools that, you know, will at least accept a bunch of people. I did want to keep going, but it kind of popped into my head. You know, I always do talk about, you know, what are some of the things that got you excited about architecture and then going through it, you know, as you started to grow up. But I have yet to ask people really, what don't they like about architecture? And And yeah, maybe that's not, you know, an easy question right away. But Matt, if you could, you know, what are some things that you don't really like about architecture?
Yeah, I can share that and what I'm trying to do about it. I touched on it actually in this exclusivity. First of all, one, the myth that everyone out of school is going to become the next Starkitect. That's also a horrible setup, and kind of it's not good for our professional culture, or not doing anybody any favors. And like, so for me, and part of it was getting practical experience earlier on, and I had internships kind of in summers between years, kind of getting my identity and learning what I loved and what I was good at and what I wasn't. That for me, but my point is I learned I wasn't going to be a designer pretty early, even in school, and I focused on the things that I did really enjoy. And then kind of to extend further, so the architect with the cape is dead. You know, architects are leaders, and we're masters of kind of bringing ideas together and collaborating. And that's a fascinating, I'm totally fascinated by consensus building, because if you do it in an authentic way, you don't actually know going in what the end result is going to be. And that's both super exciting and also a little, it's bold. You need to be able to trust that you can facilitate that process or collectively come to some meaningful solution. But then I want to go further about inclusivity. This drive, we have horrible work-life balance. Design, our professional culture has a long way to improve, or a lot of areas to improve. So, you know, it's hard because design is a never-ending process. So, you know, if you had more time, you could do more and more and more and more. And so it's hard to constrain design to a 40-hour work week or whatever it is. I personally accept that. Sometimes you need to do more, but you shouldn't always be doing more. You shouldn't always be working overtime. And if we can find a better work-life balance and a better professional culture, I believe it's good for everybody. But in particular, I think it's good for keeping women in the profession. To find more flexibility and balance will allow us to overcome some of the barriers that see people leaving the profession. So women, and probably be more appealing to a more diverse profession in general, such that we would start to look like the communities that we're trying to serve and lead in. So I just had a conversation with one of my teammates today about just that, like, hey, let's talk about your path. How's it going? Let's talk about your path and how can I help you? And how can we work together to find opportunities for you to grow in your career and do things here at our firm that you're really excited and proud of? And that's not all about just working extra hours.
Right. So,
yeah.
Right. No, that's a good point. Well, I also think, a lot of people that want to go into architecture and then, you know, they have this idea that, you know, it's going to be a lot of hours worked, and not always necessarily do you feel like, you know, that all those hours that you put in is, you know, gratified or appreciated per se. Yeah. I think also with starting to figure out how we can regulate those hours better and make those, simplify the hours to lessen them, but also make them more meaningful. I think that gives us an opportunity for people you can't say this about just like certain people aren't, but especially people that are very family oriented. At least in my case, you know, I I not only talked to my, you know, my immediate family, my mother, my father, my sister, but I also talked to all my cousins. I talked to my grandparents. I talked to my second and even some third cousins. And, you know, it's great when you have a big family like that, but it's also like, you know, that they need time, you know, to maintain those relationships. And I think, you know, a working culture that's balanced, that allows you to have that family time, is just as important. And I think that's, you know, that's something else that probably helps with the gender aspect of it too, you know, especially women that want to have children, like, you know, that's going to help out a lot.
Well, and so I have a almost 5-year-old, and, you know, having a kid, father or mother, you know, kind of changes your perspective for sure. And, you know, I ended up changing jobs to find a better work-life balance. And that's one of the reasons I'm proud to be at Smith Group for the last 2 years, is I specifically chose to join this organization because it's a good culture. And other firms that I've worked for did great work, but it was all about the work. And it was more of like a design or project focused culture. And frankly, the people were kind of replaceable, which is, it sounds awful to say, but some firms operate like that, where it's just all about the project. And, you know, now I'm happy to be at a firm that really values people. I think people that are really engaged and supported and respected are happier and do better work. So you can do great design and have a good culture. I think that's super important. A lot of this stuff, it comes down to transparency and this openness and trust. And so, you know, understanding why are you doing this, or why do you need this other option, or why do I need to stay late? Why can't this wait till tomorrow? And trusting in your team or your leadership to know that, you know, that there's a reason. I had a friend who was a really strong designer, and he felt like he would always do scheme D of the three schemes that would be presented. It was always like he did the fall off scheme, and like, you know, do that a couple times. It's pretty demoralizing to see that your ideas aren't embraced and that you just don't know how you're contributing. So yeah, it's a lot of little things, and it starts, I think, with culture and leadership to really support people and show appreciation and know that, yeah, it's not just always a production grind, that you're really providing value, and that when you can take a breath, that you should take time to do that.
Yeah. And I guess maybe one of the root of the questions, which I don't know if you'll be able to answer, it's very general in a sense. So it's a big question, but, you know, as me, I'm just starting my career, you know, working at a small firm here in St. Charles. And I always wonder, you know, how did the profession get in such a way where we felt so okay with allowing us to work such late hours and be so, you know, powerless when it came to, you know, our relationships with our clients? You know, I don't know if that's a question we can really answer, but I'm curious.
Yeah, just maybe to touch on a few things, I don't have the answer, but I'll riff with you here. I mean, I do think that there was a time, and there's still remnants of this around the master architect and the drafts people, that probably created real abusive environments. You know, I work for the genius, the revered genius, and you know, I'm lucky to have this opportunity, and I want to prove myself. And so that's probably one aspect of it, is this kind of obsession with the kind of star architect or master architect. And then also, of course, and maybe it's implied in the question, we have, somewhere along the line, we started we stopped sticking up for ourselves and collectively our profession by racing and undercutting, racing to the bottom and undercutting fees. And so, you know, our value is not measured in stacks of drawings. It's not about how much you can produce in terms of, you know, volume. In fact, you know, the way that we often organize our fee proposals is broken out certain percentages by different phases. The most important phase is the first phase. It's where you come up with the big ideas. Our value is in our design thinking and the ability to create things and to create value. And then, yeah, there's a process of discovery and problem solving. And I don't mean to kind of undercut that. And then there's an aspect of documentation that I will tell you is the piece that I think will be replaced by AI someday. And before AI, maybe it was replaced or threatened by the ability to outsource BIM models or CAD drafting or whatever it is. Our value is not in those deliverables. It's, and so then it's also in the coordination and the leadership to get things built and to get things built with the public safety in mind. So it's really front end and back end, but we should be, we shouldn't be, we should get paid for our ideas and really advocate for the value that we're bringing. I say this all the time, but it's actually really an awful thing that an architect's fee is like a rounding error in the overall project budget when you factor in construction. It really is. I mean, it's really small. And sometimes you'll find that you can save your clients a lot of money through creative thinking and, you know, bringing together the right perspectives in the room to solve problems. But oftentimes when you are, you know, negotiating or requesting a fee, you know, we get really beat up and we need to stand up for ourselves and not kind of compete to race to the bottom for the lowest fees. It's hard to do, especially now that the economy is struggling, but we'll get back.
Oh, yeah. I have no doubt we'll be back there. At least, you know, I have to have no doubt. Otherwise, I have no future.
Yeah.
Well, I want to touch a little bit on, you know, you being a principal there at Smith Group. Many people dream of being a leader, you know, in the field of architecture, especially, you know, someone like me. I definitely hope to be in a leadership position one day, and I hope to be a good leader, not just a leader, you know. So from your experience, what is one aspect you thought would be everything that you'd want it to be in your position? And what's one aspect that was just a harsh reality of your position now that you have it?
Yeah, I think you often become a leader without even knowing it. And I found that, you know, I had leadership opportunities, and it's good to kind of step back and identify the many moments in your day that are leadership roles. You are facilitating this amazing dialogue with me and many others, and sharing that's leadership. And so while you might not have a specific title that shows that, that experience adds up. A lot of my leadership journey was kind of accumulated over time. And then I realized that I kind of had gotten these skills. And a lot of them were through my involvement with AIA, the American Institute of Architects. I joined as a student, or, you know, right after graduating, and found I really craved that dialogue from school, the studio culture, talking about things that were bigger, you know, bigger ideas, And so I found AIA to be that dialogue that really excited me outside of my day-to-day work and my project and my computer. My early mentors, were involved in AIA, and I in turn got involved and then joined and became active in the Young Architects Forum. And so, a few years out of school, I was leading committee and I was organizing events, and that's project management and leadership, and public speaking. And so I felt like I was in this safe space because they were my colleagues and friends, and I was doing these things. And it was effectively a kind of a dress rehearsal. I was getting these opportunities through service before I had them in my firm. And so by the time I then had to present to a client or lead a OAC meeting or something like that, I'd kind of been there before in a lower pressure situation. So I said that you kind of find yourself as a leader before you know it. And then I knew I was a leader for a while before I had a title, which is also a challenge in the profession too. It's, certainly more than just a title, but I'll specifically say it's an old man's profession, or it's traditionally been one, and that needs to change too. But we shouldn't eat our young. And, as I've had opportunities to take on leadership roles, it's always been important to me to remember the mentoring that I got and to kind of to give back and to serve the profession, in particular the next generation, and to provide opportunities. And I think that's my platform, is to be a mentor and to make sure that I'm, leading a path and supporting others to follow. Now in the last 2 years as a principal of a firm, it's a different dynamic, because then now you have the role, the title, and the responsibility to be a leader. And people, there's a certain respect that comes with the title. It's an honor, actually, to be looked up to as a leader and to see that others believe in you. Now that we're in this pandemic and we're working remotely, and people are concerned about their health. There's social and racial inequalities that are really bubbling up, and the economy is hurting. Now is a time where leadership shows its true colors. And so, there have been difficult decisions that come along with leadership that's about either having a tough conversation with a client or a coworker, teammate. But again, to go back to the point about transparency and communication, that goes a long way. And I've been thankful that, even shifting to this remote work, getting forced into it really rapidly, I feel proud about how we have been able to handle it and been able to, one, survive, but two, to kind of thrive and to continue working. And I actually find that I know my team better now than I did 6 months ago, because this you're seeing into my home and our worlds, and it's kind of disarming. And, I feel like especially early on in the pandemic, people were, your guard was kind of down. People were a little more real and feeling like we're all in this together and taking the time to kind of connect on a personal level. Take the time to ask about kids or pets, or how was your weekend? And so I do think when we get back at it, you know, our how we work is forever changed. But we will get back together in offices again someday soon. I think we'll be better for it. Our team will be better for it. So anyway, that was a long.
No, that's great. That was really great. I just, you know, just wanted to sit there and listen for a while. you know, might as well address it, you know, from all that COVID's brought us. There's been a lot, I keep hearing a lot of bad things about, you know, cities looking like they're going to die. And I want to go ahead and put you at pro city, a pro city advocate here. And, you know, what are some things that you see or what are some, what do you see in terms of the future of the city after COVID and what are, you know, what are some strengths that are going to come out of this and make cities stronger than they were before?
Yeah. You can count on me for the pro city cheerleading. So a little bit of context. So I lead a studio that's focused on, basically office buildings, corporate and commercial buildings. And so I'm in daily conversation with clients about this issue. One, we're in the middle of a pandemic. It's a health crisis, and we're responding to that. There's a short-term situation, and then there's the long-term impacts. So I consider short-term and maybe medium-term to be until we get a vaccine. And some offices or businesses are reopening. Some have never closed. And there are certain things we need to do to maintain both health and safety and the perception of health and safety in the short term. And in the long term, I think that things will be different, but I don't think that, you know, cities are going to die or high rises are going to die or whatever. So one of the things that we've been seeing a lot of is like all of these solution providers, if you will, selling products to address really short-term needs. And frankly, people are confusing short-term and long-term a lot. Even pretty sophisticated corporate organizations and real estate professionals. You know, some furniture vendors are selling all these screens, and you're going to put up all these screens all over your office. And I have been joking, I coined the term screen washing, which is like, you know, scaring everyone to think that they need to buy all this stuff. And on a short-term basis, you might need that. But what we're actually finding is that in an office environment, most people aren't going back, or there's not the density to really require a lot of the physical distancing, the 6-foot distancing that you're hearing about. So anyway, long-term, I think we're going to get on public transportation again. I think we're going to get in elevators again. I know we're going to go to work again. And so I found there's been a lot of opportunistic marketing, if you will, or screen washing that say downtown is dead, or move to buildings that don't have high-rise elevators, or that have their own parking lot, or are in the suburbs. No doubt the future of work is changing. And I think there are two things that will come from this. One is flexibility, that a percentage of an office will work remote some of the time, maybe all the time, depending on what you do. And back to my work-life balance, I think that flexibility will be amazing if firm culture in our profession embraces that, because not everything requires you to be in the office together. And so there are definitely some focus things that you could do remotely and do it well. And the other thing is the other aspect, flexibility and wellness. You know, a focus, an increased focus on, you know, wellness, whether that's, in fact, that ties right together with flexibility as well. But looking at things like the well-building standard and Fitwell standards, and how buildings and systems can be more healthy, how we can get more fresh air, et cetera.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, I've definitely enjoyed the flexibility so far. It's been really fun. It's kind of funny because, you know, typically the idea is that you graduate and then you start working, you get used to your 9-to-5 or whatever, and it hasn't really felt that way because of this whole thing going on and the working from home. It's just been like, okay, yeah, sometimes I'll be in the office, sometimes I'm not. And that's kind of nice. And I'm fortunate enough to have that, I guess, ability early on. But, you know, not everybody did have that. So that's definitely got to be a fresh breath of air for everybody. Cool. Yeah, I think those are definitely some points, at least I haven't heard about, you know, why cities will come back stronger.
I'm so excited. I'm getting worse.
I choke on water all the time. I choke out of nowhere. I'll just, you know, I'll take a step and I'll start choking.
I was just talking about wellness and then I started.
Oh my goodness. Okay. So I have one last question. I think we have about, yeah, we're getting close. So let's go ahead and just, let me ask you this last quick question here, which isn't going to be quick, but I'm excited. So I know you worked through the recession of 2008. And a lot of people are making some sort of parallels to this time and that time. I don't know. I mean, I was too young to know, you know, so I have no idea how that was like and what we're in now. But you know, what were some of the red flags that you started to notice either within your office or within the industry that sort of, obviously in hindsight, you knew, was leading to this, you know, drop in economic expansion. And opportunities in the industry, but how did you see leadership respond? And you know, did you sort of learn anything from that?
Yeah, and I've touched on a few of those points already, but yeah, I mean, first of all, I was incredibly fortunate to stay employed through the 2008 plus recession. And so did my wife, actually, and we were among the only couples that were both in the profession that both kept our jobs. And so for me, I was working on a project that was basically a repositioning of an office building that was getting grant money from for energy efficiency, or like basically tax incentives. And so if it wasn't for the government support of that project, it probably never would have happened and I might not have stayed employed. And my wife was working on a renovation of a building as well for actually the federal courthouses downtown, which is GSA, another government project. And so, you know, we were fortunate to have those projects that kind of keep our jobs. But so many people lost work, and it was, you know, an economic collapse. And the early indicator for me in hindsight was before the office building, I was the project architect for the Godfrey Hotel on LaSalle and Huron downtown. And it's a 16-story high-rise hotel. We finished the structure, topped out the steel structure, and shortly thereafter, the developer started having some financial troubles and the project went on hold. So a tower half complete, just the contractor had to demobilize and walk away one day. And that happened fairly early on. I think it was in 2008. And as it turned out, that project sat there for, I think, 4 years, just unfinished. And fortunately, someone rescued it and finished the project eventually. And so it was kind of before there were layoffs, and didn't really make the connection at the time, but that was early, a bit of an early indicator. And I'm sure that as that project was having challenges and maybe and just couldn't get money to continue to finish the project. So now, by the way, I didn't get laid off then, but I have been laid off two different times earlier in my career. So even before that, in 2001, there was a dot-com, kind of a tech bubble burst. And it was a tough time, not as deep as 2008. And so I actually got laid off from two different jobs around that time period. So you know what it's like to be let go, and kind of you feel really, take it personally and feel betrayed. And I also now know what it's like to be left behind. And so it's very scary to be at a firm, especially a bigger firm, where oftentimes there are layoffs and, kind of staffing changes, but it's not talked about. And so you kind of find out through the grapevine who is no longer with the company. And then you wonder about the next week if there's going to be more. And so that was then. And so what we try to do now, and what I learned, and I guess we learned, is that we have a pretty transparent conversation with the whole office about how we're doing financially, and that that we're making some austerity measures, and even down to the point where we said in the staffing meeting that we are renegotiating with our coffee vendor about trying to cut costs in absolutely every way possible to just be smart and to be able to kind of meet our business goals for the year. And so, and unfortunately, we have had to lay off some people this year. And in a strong culture, I think it's even harder, to have to make that decision. And because, we like each other, and we are close and we care about each other. And unfortunately, and like I said, it's happened to me before, that somewhere you have to understand that there are very difficult business decisions. And so we've chosen to talk about it and to invite a dialogue and open up to people having questions about it, rather than be secret and hide. And so, similar to the point about collaboration, not knowing the ending, we've had all staff meetings this year that didn't have an agenda. And it's kind of scary to not necessarily have the answers or have something to say, but just having the ability to have a conversation, to have people be heard that are scared or concerned. And I think that that's a healthy thing, and it helps to just kind of build the culture and to have people feel like there's at least communication awareness. It might not always be good news, but you at least know.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's honestly, that's kind of a great way to sort of round it up here. For people that are just starting their careers, someone like me, and for students who are getting ready to start their careers, what is some advice that you would give them, about just getting into this field? And, for people who have listened so far, they've learned a lot for sure. But what else, can you give them to help them, when they're just starting off?
Yeah, be curious and dabble. I have worked at a handful of firms and worked at some small firms and some big firms and a few in between. And to the extent that you have the luxury to dabble, especially when you're a student, when you might get the opportunity to do internships, you know, try new things, firms of different sizes, maybe try a different city. Although I don't know why you wouldn't want to be an architect in Chicago.
Yeah, it's tough. we're spoiled.
And so, you know, dabble is certainly one. Two, I think I talked a bit about learning that I wasn't a designer at an early age and kind of accepting that. You know, trying to be true to yourself and try to reflect on what you like and what you're good at, I think is good. And, you know, I work at a great firm. I have a great job. I've had good fortune to have really wonderful clients and projects in my career, but I'm certainly not the most talented architect. I don't have the best design portfolio. And so I feel like hard work and perseverance trumps, sorry for that term, beats, you know, design talent. Hard work beats talent any day. And so I think when you're really committed to something, you really can meet your goals. I know that kind of sounds cheesy, but I truly believe that, you know, there are multiple paths to success. Yeah, so, and it's an incredibly rewarding profession. It's hard, but there's nothing better than to be able to, you know, kind of work with clients and communities to imagine a world that doesn't exist and to help to make that become a reality. What's cooler than that? It's like being a kid.
It's like your imagination, you know, just being built, or at least helping somebody's imagination get built up. Awesome, Matt. Well, hey, I want to thank you for, you know, taking the time to sit with me here and have this conversation. And I hope people who have listened, you know, have learned a lot from this. I definitely did, you know, a lot of, from what you've gone through is really interesting. So I really appreciate you taking the time to share that with us. Again, thank you guys so much for listening in on today's episode of Student Architect. Thank you to Matt Dumich for taking the time to sit down with me. Hope you guys learned a lot from this episode. I definitely did. And if you want to connect more with Matt, you can find him on LinkedIn, Instagram. He is a photographer, so you definitely want to check out some of his stuff. He does like to travel around the world, so he's got a lot of great pictures. And you can find him on any other spot, especially involving Smith Group, where he works currently. As always, you can find Student Architect on Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, so on and so forth. Check us out there. Keep in touch. Got plenty of more content. I got a bit of a couple of busy weeks ahead of me, but after the tides sort of balance out, should be good to go and be coming back with a lot more content. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and I'll see you guys in the next episode. Bye-bye.